This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. About 100,000 people in the U.S. have an inherited blood disorder called sickle cell disease. It's common among several ethnic groups. People of African descent are hit hardest. One out of 12 African Americans carries the gene for this disease. One out of 12. Sickle cell can cause sudden episodes of excruciating pain. It can lead to strokes, difficulty in breathing, organ failure, premature death. For about 20 years, there was only one drug used to treat this disease. A second drug was approved just last summer. Now, a much rarer blood disorder, hemophilia, afflicts about 20,000 Americans, mostly white males. But there are 28 drugs for hemophilia. Two for sickle cell. Why has so little research funding gone to find new treatments or a cure for sickle cell? Today we'll hear from a range of experts and patients, and we'd like to hear from you too. Share what you know about living with and fighting sickle cell disease. Email 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us from WYPR Public Radio in Baltimore is Dr. Sophie Lanskron, an associate professor of medicine and the director of the Sickle Cell Center for Adults at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Lanskron, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us from WBEZ Public Radio in Chicago is Jenny Gold, a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Jenny, welcome.
Thanks so much.
And here with me in studio is Ife Ahmed Williams, the founder of Destiny Despite Diagnosis. She has sickle cell disease and is an advocate for others with sickle cell. Ife, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Ife, let me start with you first of all. The description that I laid out sounds pretty dire. You know, there's a lot that sickle cell disease can do to debilitate one. How are you? How is living with sickle cell for you these days?
Well, it's winter, so it's a little rocky, but I would say overall life is good, and one should have a positive attitude whenever you're facing a chronic illness. At least I believe that, and that's what I teach others, and that's what I say when I'm educating others.
What is it about winter that makes it rocky for you?
It's cold.
Well, yeah. Nothing related to the disease.
Yeah. It's related to the disease. So the cold makes you more achy. It causes your blood cells that are already sickled, makes it more difficult to get through your blood veins, and that causes pain. That can also be caused by really heavy winds in the fall. And also rain affects me greatly as well.
Can you go into a little detail? I don't want to get super excruciating detail, so if I push too hard, feel free to push back, but can you describe what the pain is like that you deal with sickle cell? Is it a tingling? Is it a burning? Is it numbness? Is it stabbing? Like, what is that like when an attack hits?
So I would say of the 100,000 plus, which I believe there are more than that, and that's a total different discussion while we don't know exactly how many people have sickle cell disease, I would say you'd probably get 100,000 different answers. So for me, the pain feels, you take the sharp end of a hammer and just imagine it jamming in your veins, in your hands, in your feet, on your back, that's how it feels to me.
And this can be provoked by, you said, the weather.
But it can be provoked by nothing at all. It can be provoked by the weather. Fatigue, stress is a major factor, at least for me. And most of my friends and people that I associate with, speak to other patients and families, notice that stress is a major contributor to pain crisis as well.
Dr. Lanskron, let me shift over to you and get a clearer definition of sickle cell disease. What exactly is the disease? What's involved in it?
So as you described, it's a disease people are born with, and it involves the hemoglobin, which is the part of the red cell that carries oxygen to tissues. So the hemoglobin is abnormal, and it causes the red cell to change shape, and there are problems with the delivery of oxygen to tissue, which is what causes a lot of the painful events that you've described and that Ife has described. Also, those changes to the red cell and the breaking down of the red cell causes a lot of organ damage, which we see later on in life with people with sickle cell disease, although even very young people can have complications, such as you mentioned stroke, which happens in children, kidney disease, which can be found at a very early age, an increased risk for infection. It really affects every organ of the body.
So the disease has a biochemical manifestation in terms of hemoglobin, but it also has a physical manifestation with the actual shape of your red blood cells. It's shaped like a crescent moon, like a sickle.
Correct. And that abnormal shape leads to a lot of downstream effects. There's an increase in adhesion at the environment within the blood vessels is very sticky, and the red cells become stuck and block off blood vessels so that areas beyond those blockages don't receive oxygen, and that causes pain.
So if we're picturing the blood vessels in the body and the arteries and the veins and the capillaries, the sickle-shaped, the regular red blood cells flow kind of neatly, kind of spongy, mm-hmm. disc-shaped cells. But the sickle-shaped cells get caught, they get stuck, they just don't move through our pipes properly.
That's correct.
We talk about sickle cell disease, but there's also sickle cell trait. Explain the difference, please.
So people with sickle cell trait carry only one abnormal gene. So it's when two parents, a mother and a father, each carry the trait that they then can have a child who has both abnormal genes and has the disease.
Some of us learned about sickle cell as kids. I think a lot of us who grew up in African American communities may have heard about sickle cell growing up. That's where I heard about it. A number of people may have learned about sickle cell from an interview some years ago with T-Boz from the rap group TLC. Remember them back in the day? Singer Teyon Watkins, who was T-Boz, was diagnosed with sickle cell as a child. Here's a little piece of that interview from her discussing it on Good Morning America with ABC's Robin Roberts.
The easiest way to describe it is oxygen isn't getting to our vital organs. So if it's your legs, you can't walk, your arms, you can't even hold a pencil and write. Physically and emotionally, I went through so much.
That's Teyon T-Boz Watkins from the group TLC speaking to ABC's Robin Roberts. Jenny Gold, how much do you find there is, or perhaps is not, cultural awareness of sickle cell disease? I don't hear much about it these days, but what about you?
There's very little dialogue about sickle cell disease, and that's really interesting because it actually affects a fair number of people, and it's a really serious chronic illness. You hear a lot about other diseases, things like breast cancer and lung cancer, of course, that affect a lot of people, but also diseases like ALS. Do you remember the bucket challenge, the ice bucket challenge? That raised $115 million. That's a disease that affects far fewer people than sickle cell disease, and yet you don't hear about sickle cell much. So in my reporting, I kind of tried to figure out why that might be.
What do you think are some of the big factors as to why we don't hear more about sickle cell? Is it just because it afflicts fewer people, perhaps, than different forms of cancer or cardiovascular disease?
It certainly affects fewer people than cardiovascular disease and some types of cancer, of course, but there are still plenty of rare diseases that you hear more about. I think a lot of this, not just what you're hearing, but also drug development, access to care, unfortunately, comes down to discrimination. As you mentioned before, sickle cell is a disease that affects mostly people of color. And there just has been so much less drug development than there has been for other diseases. Now, whether that's pure discrimination or whether that has to do with how much drug companies think they're going to make on those drugs once they enter the market, you know, that's an open question. But this is, it's hard to look at this disease and not see discrimination.
I do want to talk more about that as we continue our conversation with Jenny Gold of Kaiser Health News, Ife Ahmed Williams of Destiny Despite Diagnosis, and Dr. Sophie Lanskron of the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. We'd love to hear from you too. Share what you know about living with or fighting sickle cell disease, particularly if you happen to be involved in research or advocacy. What are you seeing as a researcher or as someone who's trying to raise funds for research? If you are listening, we'd love to know what's out there, what's going on, what the impediment is. Do you believe it is racially motivated or racially ideated? Or is it more than that? What do you think needs to happen to finally make progress in fighting sickle cell disease? Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Before we have to pause for this segment, Dr. Lanskron, we've talked a bit about African Americans being affected. What other populations tend to be affected by sickle cell?
So the origin of the gene mutation occurred in places where there was malaria, because having sickle trait protects you from dying from malaria. You can still get it, but you're far less likely to die from it. So anywhere where there was malaria, there is sickle cell disease. So we see it in Southeast Asia, we see it in the Middle East. There are Hispanic populations who also carry the gene. And we know now that there are other emerging populations as people sort of intermix that could very well have sickle cell disease.
And we should be clear, there is no cure for sickle cell disease, right?
Well, we are using stem cell transplant to cure people with sickle cell disease. It isn't universally available. It's still considered research, at least for the adult population, as a curative therapy, as we still figure out how to do it better with fewer complications and more successes.
Okay, so it's proven promising, but it hasn't gone through the whole FDA approval process to be widely available.
Correct. It's still being researched or being done under the research premise.
Before we pause, Ife?
Because it's still being researched, it is for a lot of patients and their families quite a scary thought because of a lot of the side effects that can come from it.
So even if it was available to them, there's still some skepticism about even trying it.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Well, there's much more that we can discuss about sickle cell, and we shall do so momentarily with Ife Ahmed-Williams of Destiny Despite Diagnosis, Jenny Gold of Kaiser Health News, and Dr. Sophie Lanzkron of the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Brad asked a good question, sickle cell disease versus sickle cell anemia. There are a number of different kinds of this disease. Should have clarified that before. Brad, thank you. We will answer your question as we continue thinking through sickle cell and what can be done to help people living with the disease in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the fight against sickle cell disease with Dr. Sophie Lanzkron, director of the Sickle Cell Center for Adults at Johns Hopkins, Jenny Gold of Kaiser Health News, and Ife Ahmed-Williams, who has lived for decades with sickle cell disease and is the founder of Destiny Despite Diagnosis. Brad asked a good question. Dr. Lanzkron, sickle cell disease versus sickle cell anemia. I think growing up, I heard a lot about sickle cell anemia, but what's the difference? Are they the same thing? Or is one kind of a component of the other?
So sickle cell disease is the term we use to encompass all different types of sickle cell disease. There are other mutations of hemoglobin, such as hemoglobin C or a thalassemia mutation, that when coupled with an S sickle mutation causes sickle cell disease. But the most severe form of sickle cell disease is what we call sickle cell anemia, where you inherit an S from mom and an S from dad, and really you only make hemoglobin S. And also people who have another very rare mutation called beta zero thalassemia, which when coupled with S, you really only make sickle hemoglobin.
Ife, do you know what kind of sickle cell disease you have?
I do. I have SS disease. And when I do education and workshops, I make a point for people to know if they don't know, and they should find out, because it's very important in how you treat your disease.
Condolences to George M., who wrote in saying that he lost a friend to this disease, also noted about it being a mutation to protect one from malaria. Jenny Gold, there was just a report a few days ago about pop star Jordan Sparks, who lost four loved ones back to back to back to back, including one who died of sickle cell. I believe it was her stepsister, Brianna Jackson Frias, who died at age 16 about a week ago of sickle cell. It seems like that's kind of when, I wonder if in your research you find that's kind of when it hits home, that people don't really think much about it until someone becomes, you know, mortally hospitalized or someone passes away.
It's just a terrible story that someone died at 16. Generally, pediatric care for sickle cell disease tends to be pretty good, at least definitely better than adult care for adults with sickle cell. But, you know, kids still have strokes, they still have multi-organ failure, and they can still die. Life expectancy for people with sickle cell tends to be in the late 30s. What was really interesting to me in my research was that sickle cell life expectancy has actually been dropping. In 1994, for example, it was 42 for men and 48 for women. But by 2005, that had dropped to 38 for men and 42 for women. It's hard to imagine other diseases in the United States where we would sort of sit back and say, oh, it's okay that life expectancy is dropping. We expect medicine is getting better and better, and people are going to live longer with things like cancer and chronic illnesses. But in the case of sickle cell, that simply hasn't been the case. And in particular, there's a spike in deaths right after patients leave their pediatric programs. That tends to happen around 18. People age out of those peds programs and have to find another source of care. And unfortunately, for many people, that source of care just doesn't exist. They can't find in their area a clinic that specializes in adults with the disease.
Do we know why the overall life expectancies are dropping?
Well, I think we believe it's about access to care. Hydroxyurea, this one drug that's been approved since 1998 for sickle cell disease, it's out there. It's available. It's actually really inexpensive. It's less than $100 a month for patients. And yet, we know that 3 in 4 patients, 75% of patients who could benefit from this drug aren't being treated with it. And that's in part because they can't find these specialty centers and because family physicians aren't comfortable, they say, with caring for sickle cell patients, perhaps because they don't have enough training to deal with this very complex disease. A survey in 2014 found that only 20% of family physicians said they were comfortable caring for sickle cell patients. Most doctors have only maybe 20 minutes of training in med school on how to treat it. And when patients go to the emergency room, they often face very long wait times, especially compared to other pain patients, and doctors who don't really understand how to treat the disease.
Dr. Lance Cron, how much training does it really take to deal with someone with sickle cell disease? At first, it seems weird that many doctors would say, oh my God, I'm not ready to do this. But is it complicated? I mean, do you really have to be a hematologist, a blood doctor to deal with sickle cell? Or is this something that doctors are just kind of being cowardly about touching?
No, I think one of the main issues and problems is the lack of a good evidence base. Everybody wants to practice evidence-based medicine, and that's true for people, the care that people want to provide to folks with sickle cell disease. Unfortunately, because of the limited research, there really isn't a strong evidence base. So it's really hard to say, well, I have a patient who looks like this. I'll just look up in a journal or in an article or other resources that we use to figure out best practice to figure out exactly what to do. There are guidelines that were published by the NIH in 2014. But if you look through that, a lot of those recommendations are based on consensus. So the way I learned how to do this is because I do it a lot. I take care of over 500 adults with this disease. And that's how I became an expert in doing this. And I think that's what makes it frustrating for other providers is that there isn't this wealth of data on exactly how to take care of the adult population in particular.
I want to hear from Ife in just one second, but doctor, I want you to break this down for me because I'm not a doctor. So if I am presented with an African-American patient who manifests symptoms like, you know, anemia levels and fatigue and unexplained bouts of pain, maybe a patient that has a stroke, and I know that these kinds of symptoms affect Black people in ways that make them more likely for sickle cell disease, what you're saying to me is that that's not enough for me to say, you might have sickle cell. I'm not understanding how more doctors aren't going, this could be sickle cell, and at least begin to suss that out. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, so we should be clear that in this country, there's newborn screening. And so pretty much everyone gets diagnosed at the time they're born in this country. There are some people who sort of escaped that or moved here from other places. So it's not an issue of diagnosis. Most people know that they have sickle cell disease. It's really how you manage it on a day-to-day basis.
Gotcha.
What kind of recommendations for therapy that you provide.
Ife, does that reflect your experience dealing with doctors in sickle cell?
Some of it, I would say some of that is accurate, but I would say that a lot of it is also based on health disparities in our country. And we know that health disparities are often based on biases in race, in gender, in economics. And for sickle cell patients, I find that I have experienced both. So yes, people know that I have sickle cell disease, or you go to the doctor, you know, you can even tell them. So I think diagnosis, she's correct, is not an issue. The issue is the patients. It also takes patience to care for a person that has sickle cell disease, because you can't just go and cure them. If I present to the emergency room, you can make me feel better and send me home, but you're not going to cure me, and I'm going to show up again. And I think for some providers, that's not as attractive. It's not sexy. It's not groundbreaking. And so
it's not that profitable.
It's not profitable, exactly. And so that, I think, is also an issue. And I think also another thing that I'm experiencing often with providers is just their lack of knowledge. And some of it is their lack of wanting to care for patients. Sometimes I'm just pushed to the side. You're thrown in the room, depending on where you are. So you know that you're being treated a certain way because you have this particular condition.
Glad to hear some of you sharing your stories about dealing with sickle cell. Lawana emailed, "My husband and both my sons, age 16 and 23, have sickle cell trait. We've talked to them since they were old enough to understand what the ramifications of this are. I'm not surprised that there is little research or gains made in this disease due to the audience it afflicts." Let's bring in one more voice who can speak to dealing with sickle cell firsthand. Joining us now from Lisle, Illinois, which is west of Chicago, is Marcus Valentine. He was diagnosed with sickle cell disease as a little kid, and he helped found the advocacy group called Sick Cells. Marcus, welcome to 1A.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm good. What was the earliest memory you have of knowing that there was something different, something wrong with the way that your body worked? How did you learn about sickle cell as a kid?
I learned through being hospitalized, and my mom, who is a RN, she kind of, you know, sat me up and talked to me about the illness I have due to, you know, all the stuff that I was going through at the time. And so I learned about it quite early. I have sickle cell hemoglobin SS, and I was diagnosed at 6 months. So when I got my most recent memory of knowing about it was when I got my first Portacath. I remember being a struggle to understand why I was being stuck with so many IVs and how come I needed the IVs. And so when I got my first port, we talked about it and what was happening to me and how my life was going to be.
And I'm sorry, a Portacath, it's a device that's used it's that needle they put in to draw blood and they give IV fluids. It's one of the, they put it in and kind of leave it in.
Yeah, it's under the skin, usually sits in the upper left or right chest, and there's a tube that sits in the right atrium of the heart that runs from the device. So it's like a internal IV that lasts, once they access it, the needle stays in for 7 days, as opposed to, you know, the regular IV where they have to look for a vein on your arm.
Right.
And they last pretty long if you take good care of them.
I understand that sickle cell has been pretty severe for you. You had a stroke in fourth grade, is that right?
Yes.
And as I understand, the school wasn't sure what was happening with you. As they tell me that the teachers thought you were just acting up in class.
Yeah. I went to the nurse's office, and I had explained to her that I had a cut in my visual field. Like, if you were to take your hand and put it in front of your eye, that's how I was seeing. Huh. I couldn't see, like, there was just a line down my eye. And when I went to the nurse's office, they believed this is when I was having the stroke. I was, like, she was asking me questions, but I wasn't responding, and I was fidgeting with stuff. So they sent me back to class, and I had a aide who noticed that I couldn't spell words that I learned a year prior. And later on, I had gone in for a whole other procedure, I believe, and they did a MRI, and they realized that part of my brain was not showing. It damaged. They compared it to earlier scans of my head, and they found it, and it kind of had been a bane on my existence because it popped back up later on in life, and I developed epilepsy due to it.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Marcus, I understand that being able to live just an average life has been pretty tough. Being able to hold down a job or just being able to move without pain. What's your perspective on how well or poorly you've been treated by doctors, by healthcare communities with regards to having sickle cell? Have you been able to find what you needed, or has it been a fight?
It's been a little of both. I have had it where it's gone very smooth and everything was very well. And then I've had it where I had to fight for every single thing. And it seems like I'm fighting more than being helped. And now part of the fight isn't due to my doctors. It's due to some of the things that need to be done. For example, when I had my knee replaced in the early 2000s, Blue Cross wanted me to put, they wanted the surgeon to put in just a fake knee, like a knee replacement, instead of a cartilage and bone graft. And the reason he wanted the bone graft was because it becomes a part of me, whereas every 10 to 15 years, he would have to go back in and replace the knee that they wanted him to put in, the fake prosthetic. And so we had to fight for that.
And I just want to make sure that the knee replacement, was that connected to sickle cell, or was that separate?
Yeah. Okay. I lost circulation, and the blood flow just stopped, and part of my knee started dying because of it.
Marcus, I know we have to keep moving in just a second, but I think your story is probably blowing somebody's mind right now who didn't even know either what sickle cell disease was or knew about it, but didn't know that it could be this severe. What would help folks like you the most going forward? If there's one thing that you would ask empathetic people to start advocating for, what would be the most beneficial to you right now?
The most beneficial would be for the the medical community as a whole to listen to what the patients need, and then once we explain what we need, to then turn around and do it without having to question us or us having to fight for each inch, because you know it's stressful enough living with the disease, and then you know, you have to fight for every little thing, and that just adds more stress, which then winds up, you know, you wind up hospitalized. So I just want more advocacy to go into the medical profession for them to know that sickle cell and people who are dealing with it, you know, they're not doing this because they want to. They're doing it because they have to.
Right. Marcus Valentine, he and his sister Ashley co-founded the group Six Cells. You'll find a link to it on our website, the1a.org. Marcus, all the best to you, my friend. Thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
I know we have to pause in a minute, but Ife, how much does Marcus's story sound like what some of the folks you work with do? I see you nodding your head. Is this kind of a common scenario?
It is a common scenario, and he's absolutely right. There are times when you are able to get really great care, and there are times where everything is a fight. And I think that the reason why you're seeing the research and things go down for adults is because adults are not as cute and cuddly as kids are. Adults don't have people standing by when they go to the ER. Most of the time when I go to the ER, I'm alone. So I don't have a mom and a dad and a grandmom standing there like I did when I was a child. And I think other things that are going on in our society as a whole are beginning to affect the way in which we're treated, such as the opioid crisis. So if I have a crisis, I have to go to the hospital and get pain meds, IV therapy. There really is nothing else that's going to get me out of pain. But if you're living in a country where now everybody's using opioids and it's being seen as people are abusing it, then people that need opioids therapy are not really being able to get it. If you have cancer, you're able to get it. But if you have sickle cell, people are looking at you and they're thinking, are you really in pain?
Yeah, we got some questions about the opioid crisis and whether that is making things worse. Jenny Gold, I wonder if when we come back, if you could take on that question about maybe the opioid crisis and the impact of that. Also, Moondogs wrote on Twitter, really? You don't hear about it because it affects blacks. This is America. Is it that cut and dry? How much does race factor into the future of fighting sickle cell? Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program on political polling. 2016 was a bad year for pollsters. It seems just about everyone got the election wrong, predicting Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. That led to a lot of soul searching for polling organizations and news organizations. But what difference do these polls actually make to you? When was the last time a political poll affected you directly? Were you surveyed about your opinion? Maybe you read a poll and it affected your vote, or affected whether you showed up to vote. Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. Do you trust political polls? Tell us why or why not, especially if you have interacted with pollsters directly. 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212. We will talk about polling and share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation about the fight against sickle cell. A number of you have shared some genuine horror stories, like the one that came from one of our anonymous listeners who wrote, "My wife has it, and on one particularly bad episode, we had to call an ambulance. I was not home. The ambulance crew treated her like she was faking the pain. They would not give her a blanket or cover her feet. They carelessly put her feet over a bar on the gurney. Horrible treatment, a form of torture when a person is in such pain. She vowed to never go to the hospital again." Jenny, I wonder if you could respond to that, and maybe also to Nick, who asked, "I know that sickle cell patients are often not believed when they go to an emergency department where they are not known. Does the opioid crisis make it worse?"
Well, that's a really heartbreaking story. Yeah. I'm so sorry for that person who wrote in. Yes, the opioid epidemic is absolutely having an effect on sickle cell patients who present in the emergency room. There's, for good reason, a fear of people drug-seeking when they go to the emergency room. Some people are going in, asking for opioids because they have an addiction problem. And that's having a terrible effect on people with sickle cell who have real pain. They're presented and are often treated as drug-seeking. I heard that time and time again from the patients that I spoke with, that they felt like they were being treated like a heroin user or some kind of opioid addict when they asked for pain in the midst of what, you know, for them felt like a horrific pain crisis. We know that people with sickle cell disease have to wait up to 50% longer for help in the emergency department than other patients who present with pain. This may have to do with their race. I think, you know, discrimination should absolutely be looked at in this situation. We know that sickle cell patients are more likely to have to be readmitted to the hospital within 30 days than any other patient. That's really striking. Hospitals look at the number of people who have to be readmitted after being released within that next 30-day period, and sickle cell patients are the most likely. So we know that they're not getting the care that they need when they're presenting.
Another one of our listeners, Snowflakes, emailed, "In the late 80s, I worked in our local ER. We had a 16-year-old male with sickle cell who started coming to the ER for pain relief. The doctors knew nothing to do but give him higher and higher levels of pain meds as the pain continued to increase. We all got to love this boy and were sick when he became addicted and finally killed himself, just shy of his 18th birthday." Ife, that seems like an extreme case, but is it?
Well, I've never heard of that. I'm sure
that's a relief, by the way.
That is a relief.
Yeah.
I am sure that people do become addicted, but studies are showing that the population of people that have sickle cell disease are not any more addicted than the regular population of people. So then that means that there are other people that are becoming addicted as well. And also, just because you may become addicted from the use or dependent from the use of the drugs doesn't mean that when you present you're not on, doesn't mean that you're not in pain. And so to not treat me when I'm in pain because you think I may become addicted is very cruel also. And that often will cause the reason why people are coming back is because it takes a long time to get the pain under control, then they may be released with less meds than they need, and also then they're not having really good follow-up care. And I think that what Dr. Lance Cron is doing at the Sickle Cell Center in Baltimore is she's coupling the need for long-term regular care, primary care, and she's stressing the importance of a more holistic wraparound services as opposed to just coming and being seen in the ER. You cannot stay healthy as a sickle cell patient without a hematologist, without a primary care physician, and just using the emergency room for your main treatment. It's just not possible.
Dr. Lance Cron, we've mentioned hydroxyurea a couple of times so far. Can you talk, I wonder if there's a way to explain kind of in layman's terms what hydroxyurea does for a sickle cell patient and what makes it effective?
So hydroxyurea is a great medication for the treatment of people with sickle cell anemia. So really focused on the folks who have SS disease. We talked earlier about the red cell changing shape, and that's because the hemoglobin molecules inside that red cell stick together. So hydroxyurea increases fetal hemoglobin, which is another type of hemoglobin. And in the presence of fetal hemoglobin, it's much harder for those hemoglobin molecules to stick together. And we see less of the red cells changing shape, less breakdown of those red cells. And it's a very effective therapy in decreasing the frequency of crises. I think the
I'm sorry, when you say crises, you mean those bouts of pain. It's called a crisis.
Exactly. Sorry, those painful episodes. And I think that the tragic stories and what Ife mentioned, it really speaks to the need for access to high-quality care and comprehensive care to help manage all of these aspects of the disease, including the appropriate use of opioid therapy.
And can you talk about the new treatment that came online last summer, I think it was, Dr. Lance Cron? What does that do that's different than what hydroxyurea does? Or does it do the same thing but better?
So L-glutamine is the new drug that was just FDA approved. It is an amino acid that decreases crisis frequency. It works under a different mechanism than hydroxyurea. Hydroxyurea probably, because it works in a number of different ways, so I mentioned one way in which it works, which was by increasing fetal hemoglobin. It has a number of different ways it works. It's probably, in the end, going to be a more effective therapy than L-glutamine, but certainly we are all considering L-glutamine as a good choice as an additional medication on top of hydroxyurea to help control painful episodes.
And I should note, some of us who spend a lot of time at Vitamin Shop know that you can buy L-glutamine as a powder form, as a sports supplement, but I think what you're talking about is something that is a different kind of a presentation in a laboratory grade that's kind of designed for a pharmaceutical use. This isn't quite the same as what you buy from a health food store.
Exactly. This is an FDA-approved supplement, or the same amino acid. It's just FDA approved and so more regulated in the way it's made.
We should talk about the aspect of race on all of this. At least one of our listeners was thoroughly moved by some of what she's heard so far and tweeted, "Marcus's story breaks my heart. Why are we not doing more to help this courageous young man and all the other children and adults like him? Racism is the only answer I can come up with. This is outrageous. We must do better. We must demand better." Moondogs tweeted, "Really? You don't hear about it because it affects blacks. This is America." However, Grant asked, "Could it also be that a way to treat sickle cell is inherently more difficult than hemophilia? Hemophilia is a condition that affects the ability to clot, whereas sickle cell deals with the formation of blood cells. It might just be easier to solve the clotting problem and not have much to do with discrimination at all." Dr. Lance Cron, let's start with Grant's question, the inherent difficulty of the medical challenge. I tend to think that challenges get easier the more resources you throw at them, but that's just me. I don't work in the lab. What do you think of his research question?
You can't ignore that there's a health disparity here. And whether that has to do with race, it probably does, but you can't ignore that there's been decrease in both federal funding and public funding for research in sickle cell disease. But Grant does bring up an interesting point. Because pain is subjective, it has been very difficult to identify outcomes for research studies when your endpoint is the resolution of pain, which is very subjective, and that's been a challenge. But there's been a lot more research and a lot more pharmaceutical companies that are investing in the research, looking at much better outcomes. And so we have, you're right, with resources, overcome some of those challenges. And so that the inability to have a really good outcome is a small piece of the story. I think a bigger part is that for a long time, the amount of funding that was provided to help treat and cure this disease has not been as much as some other rare diseases that were mentioned earlier today.
Jenny Gold, what do you think? Is this about research or is this about race?
Well, I think we can just look at the numbers here. Let's move away from hemophilia and take cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis affects 30,000 people in the U.S. That's less than a third of sickle cell disease. And yet they are getting 7 to 11 times more funding per patient than sickle cell disease in federal funding. That's a huge disparity in funding. And it is that funding that leads to better research and better, not only better drugs, but also these protocols that we mentioned before. How do you even treat someone with sickle cell disease? How many people have sickle cell disease? What's the best thing to do when they present at the emergency room? Well, there hasn't even been funding to create a disease registry from the CDC to answer some of these questions. We simply don't know how to treat people appropriately. I would also bring up the fact that we've known about sickle cell disease for a pretty long time. It was first found in the early 1900s by looking at blood cells under the microscope, which I find totally fascinating. It's actually considered the first molecular disease ever found, and it helped launch the field of molecular biology. And there's been a ton of lab science, like just bench science, looking at the mechanisms of sickle cell disease, and it's taught us a tremendous amount about basic science. And yet very little of that research actually went towards improving care for patients.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Ife, you had mentioned earlier about the difficulty in figuring out how many people even have sickle cell disease. I wonder if that dovetails into the question about race, where maybe the fact that there is no, federal registry, the surveillance is weak, and then the research is weak, and so the cures are fewer. If all of this kind of dovetails into race, that may be an accurate and actual answer. I think race also makes some people fling their hands up and go, well, what do you want me to do about it? I can't solve race. Like, how do we move forward through that, especially if the genesis of this problem is directly related to the fact that black folks have health disparities that just aren't being fixed?
Well, I think like all problems, there are a variety of things that have caused it to be that way, and it needs to be tackled from a variety of angles. And I think for advocates and for patients, we're looking at it in our daily lives, and we want to have better quality of life and better care. And providers and scientists are looking at it as a way of doing research. And so everybody has a different way of which they're looking at it. So it is clear that it is, a health disparity issue. I have been a part of meetings and where there have been discussions about developing a surveillance. But as I talk to patients and families, just the fact of calling it surveillance makes them feel uncomfortable, many patients and families. So just if you can't get over what it's called, that in and of itself becomes an issue.
Because communities of color have very good reasons to distrust the medical establishment, the Tuskegee experiment,
exactly,
and so on.
Exactly. And just that word surveillance. We feel like we're being surveilled all the time.
Exactly.
So I think little things like that are important. Language is important. Presentation is important. I think also it is important for us as a community to be more active, to be more educated ourselves, and to speak more clearly with one voice instead of 2, 3, 5, 6 voices.
Speaking of language, I know we're really low on time, but for someone who finds out, Ife, that a loved one, a friend, a coworker has sickle cell and is dealing with it, what would you recommend for us in terms of being good friends to them? Are there certain things that people living with sickle cell get tired of hearing, get tired of having to explain, the same kind of gaffes that come up over and over? Like, if I don't want to seem like, if I don't want to look stupid when I'm trying to be nice and trying to be like, oh my God, is there anything I can do for you? I'm so sorry. Is there anything you need? Like, what makes us good friends to someone living with sickle cell?
I think that most patients and families are very understanding. And so the first thing that makes you a good friend is just the fact that you care and you want to know, that you're inquisitive, that you're kind, that you care. And I think you should also look at it the same way as you look at buying a new pair of shoes or a new movie that's coming out. You go online, you look it up, where is it playing, what's it about? So we're willing to do research on all types of trivial things, but we're not willing to do research on things that we've heard of and don't know more about. So I call sickle cell disease the I've heard of it. If you've taken 10th grade biology and you've talked about genetics, you've heard of sickle cell disease. It's always talked about, just like color blindness. So what is it that's going to push you further than what you learned in class or the friend that you know that has it? The other thing is just simply to ask. It's okay to ask.
I wonder if, doctor, if you could give us a sense of, are any new medications coming online? Very briefly, Henri asked about a medication called drapanostat that's being used in West Africa. Are there any promising new treatments or studies underway that you're keeping an eye on, briefly?
So there are a number of different studies. There's been a lot more interest from the pharmaceutical companies. So there are medicines that are being worked on to sort of decrease the stickiness, the sticky environment within the blood vessels. And so there are a number of different therapies that hopefully will be coming out in the next few years to address that aspect of sickle cell disease. What would be great and what we're really looking for is something that sort of stops a painful episode in its tracks, opposed to just sort of masking it, which is what we do with opioids. And so hopefully some therapies are coming out to address that as well. And gene therapy, there was a proof of concept paper published about a 13-year-old child who was treated with gene therapy. And so that's also a clinical trial that's ongoing.
And Jenny Gold, very briefly, where do you see the cultural conversation around sickle cell going from here? Any prospects for improved attention or improved funding for research?
I mean, I think it would be great if you could have some kind of superstar like LeBron James come out and make a big deal about sickle cell and start some kind of national conversation. I think that could make a huge difference. I also just want to give a little bit of hope here amidst a lot of sadness, which is that there are places that are doing a good job taking care of sickle cell patients. Places like Hopkins or the Oakland Children's Hospital that treats adults in California. Those places like that have actually been able to get life expectancy into the 60s by doing things that we already have, hydroxyurea and other treatments. So, you know, hope is out there. I think a lot of this is really an access issue.
Jenny Gold, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thank you, Jenny.
Sure. Thank you.
Dr. Sophie Lanskron of Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.
And Ife Ahmed Williams of Destiny Despite Diagnosis. Ife, thank you.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.